It's Wednesday, February 17th, 2021, and this is another socially distant edition of KBIA's Views of the News. I'm Amy Simons, coming to you from the studio in the Reynolds Journalism Institute. My colleagues Ernest Perry and Kathy Kiley are here with me via Skype for our weekly conversation on media behaviors. Hi to you, Ernest.
Hello.
And Kathy, it's good to have you with us today, too.
Hi, Amy.
On our program this week, coverage of the second impeachment trial of Donald Trump, which ended on Saturday, as expected, with the former president's acquittal. We'll also be talking about the apparent end of the Lincoln Project, just months after it was seen as the future for right-of-center media.
What do we want?
Free Britney!
When do we want it?
Now!
And we're going to talk about the questions asked and answered in the New York Times' documentary, Framing Britney Spears. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to before our time is up today. But first, news that we learned about shortly before sitting down for today's conversation, that Rush Limbaugh has died at the age of 70. His wife, Catherine, made that announcement during his radio show today. He had started that program 33 years ago on 56 radio stations across the country. Today, it's estimated that the reach of that show is about 27 million people each week. The lead on the Fox News obituary described him as the monumentally influential media icon who transformed both talk radio and politics, shaping the modern Republican Party. Ernest, your response to that description?
I think there's some accuracy to it. I would say that, you know, Rush Limbaugh was one of the people that, you know, for all intents and purposes, saved AM radio back in the 80s. I remember as a young reporter covering vast stretches of Southeast Texas, that the only thing that was on the radio was Rush Limbaugh and preseason, you know, baseball games at certain times. And this was prior to the Clinton administration. And at that time, you know, just thinking about it, listening to playing it back in my head, you know, he wasn't as bombastic as he became later. But, you know, once Clinton came into office and he really took off, and so did his connection to the Republican Party, to Newt Gingrich, to the Contract with America, so on and so forth, to where we've come to now. And so I would say that he could be called one of the icons of not only that talk radio genre, but also of AM radio in sort of its descendancy, not its ascendancy.
As you were describing that, Ernest, I actually started thinking about the period when I was listening to Rush Limbaugh regularly, which was really just that maybe year and a half when I was here in school as an undergrad and going out and reporting at KOMU, because growing up in Chicago, I was very much a fan of the talk radio genre. And here in Columbia, back in the late 90s, there were very few other outlets for talk radio. And really, that was when it was Rush Limbaugh and Dr. Laura Schlesinger on KFRU. And you brought up that idea of how he really exploded during the in popularity during the Clinton administration. And in the back of my mind, I'm thinking there's that real tie-in to when Fox News Channel really saw its birth and its growth in popularity too, and how really those two audiences kind of came together at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of that. I mean, the audiences came together. The party sort of was able to sort of find its voice, and Rush Limbaugh was one of those individuals that provided it with a voice outside of the establishment. And in many ways, he connected with the people on the ground. I would say he was probably one of the people who started the grievance part of the Republican Party and sort of pulled those people in who saw themselves as those who were going to stand up for what America used to be, in their words, this sort of homogenous kind of America, and he sort of connected with that and gave them voice through his radio show.
Kathy, he had his critics too, not only those on the left. In fact, there was even an article that you had pointed out to me as we were making some last minute changes to today's show that was in the Washington Post the other day about how in some ways the work he was doing is really beginning to kind of lose its grip.
Well, I think, you know, first of all, we should say that Rush Limbaugh is a Missouri native.
He is. And I have in front of me the statement from Roy Blunt we'll talk about in just a second.
And so, you know, he came from here, but his career really started in Sacramento, California, when he really started. He formatted the program as we know it today, and it was syndicated in 1988. I think that's an interesting year because it is the year after the FCC repealed the Fairness Doctrine. And I think that in many ways is what made Rush Limbaugh possible as a personality, because he was able to be very outspoken in the ways that Ernest described. I think the flip side of that is, you know, in many ways, Limbaugh is the precursor of Donald Trump. He was very charismatic in his bombastic ways. He was so self-assured, but he was also very argumentative and could be very negative. And I think the phrase that he coined a lot of phrases. He was a very, very much of a wordsmith, but the phrase ditto heads in some ways summarizes a lot of Limbaugh's legacy, which is you're either with me or you're against me. There's no compromise. And I think we see a lot of that legacy in today's politics, and not necessarily for the good.
So you did mention he is from Missouri, came from the Cape Girardeau area. Roy Blunt issuing a statement, our senator, a little bit earlier today, honoring his work first as a high school radio personality in Cape Girardeau all the way to the EIB network, the one that he created. And Blunt mentions that he changed the way Americans talked about issues every day. Interestingly enough, I do want to mention, I started trying to find this and I couldn't, but one of the other things worth mentioning was the team of people that were working with him. I will remember one anecdote that I had, and I was trying to find the transcript and couldn't in the time we had, but somebody somewhere had even found, who was working with him, something that I had said. And I can't remember if it was on this program or if it was in an interview that I gave shortly after the events in Ferguson, and that he was even reacting to things he was seeing and hearing in other media circles and talking about those on his show. So
one of my favorite comments in one of the bits, I think it was the one in the Washington Post, it quoted his biographer, who quoted his mom, and his mom told Rush Limbaugh's biographer that Rush did not start talking until he was two, but then he didn't stop. So, you know, it really kind of captured, you know, I think he, there was an undeniable verve about his radio personality that, that made it very appealing. But I also think, as I say, that legacy, Roy Blunt is right. It did change the way people talk about politics. But is it for the best?
Yeah, that's the point that I wanted to make, was he was taking umbrage with things we were talking about here.
Well, I think the other thing, too, is that, you know, he's what he's done in his career also has spawned Sean Hannity and all the others who are now in Fox News. And so now you've seen a sort of, as I said earlier, a descendancy of what's happening in AM talk radio. But a lot of that has moved into not only what you see in the cable networks, but also what you're seeing in the blogs, what you're seeing on social media and in other places. So, I mean, it hasn't so gone away. It sort of has morphed into and has sort of gone into other parts of the media. And now, because of, I think, Kathy, you talked about this, he was a precursor to Donald Trump. And now you're seeing a lot of that come out in other ways, and other, not only politicians, but also people who are in right-wing media are following that same path.
So while let me just go ahead and talk about this. As you bring up Donald Trump, we knew going into a new administration that there was going to be some holdover stories from the old we'd be talking about. And Saturday, one of those maybe reached its end.
the Senate judges that the respondent, Donald John Trump, former president of the United States, is not guilty as charged in the article of impeachment.
The acquittal wasn't that much of a surprise. What was some of Saturday's drama and the confusion that came with it. A vote for witnesses, then no witnesses, just a statement entered into the record, and then the vote, with seven Republicans crossing party lines with their guilty vote. Now, Kathy, one of the things that stood out in the coverage was how the results of the vote were communicated, especially in headlines and in social media posts and some of those quick take stories. A lot of them had stated that the Senate voted 57-3, finding Trump not guilty. Now, the vote was 57-43, and the result was not a not guilty verdict. But those headlines still weren't accurate, were they?
No, the 57 senators, a majority, voted to convict the former president, and 43 voted to acquit. What the headline writers, in their effort to shorthand, and I sympathize with that, but it was inaccurate because the majority of the Senate voted to convict the former president, but under the rules of the Senate, you needed a supermajority of 67 votes to convict. So the conviction failed by 10 votes, but I think it is important to note that a majority of the Senate felt he was guilty of the crime of inciting insurrection.
Other observations, when we kind of started this trial last week, we talked about it a little bit on last Wednesday's program, the majority of it happening between then and now. Ernest, maybe some observations you had during the course of the week?
Well, I think the observations over the course of the week is that the House managers on the Democratic side, I think they did a very effective job of basically lining, you know, putting their case before the public. It was straightforward. It was quick. One of the quickest that I've ever seen in the three that we've had, two with Donald Trump, one with Bill Clinton, and then you also had Trump his lawyers come in. They were pretty quick, but there was really not much of a case there. Their case was basically relitigating what the Senate had already decided upon, which was that it is constitutional for them to do what they did. And that was pretty much their case. Over the course of all of it, we all knew that they weren't going to get the 17 votes that they needed in order to convict. And ultimately, that's what we got to. And then in the end, even the Democrats themselves said, hey, let's have this vote. Let's move on. We've got to deal with COVID, with President Biden's stimulus package, so that we can move on and not talk about Donald Trump anymore. Except when we got to the end, Mitch McConnell, right after the vote, came out and pretty much laid it on former President Trump about his displeasure and everything that he did, and that there possibly could be some sort of repercussions that will befall him in the legal process. And now you have a full-on fight going on in the Republican Party to see who's going to be in control. That's the story. But as far as Washington is concerned, they're moving on into the Biden presidency to deal with COVID.
Kathy, there was a lot of confusion about the early call Saturday morning to bring witnesses, then the decision not to. And reporters really pressed House Manager Jamie Raskin on that in the post verdict, if you will, news conference. It was held Saturday afternoon. And Raskin really took umbrage with those questions. He was not happy with being asked those questions. What are your thoughts on reporters continuing to ask them? We talked about the case that was made, how strong it was. Is there a reason to ask him to justify that decision?
Oh, sure. You know, that's what reporters do. We ask pesky questions, and we should never stop doing that. I think what you're really looking at, I'm laughing because when that happened on Saturday, mm-hmm. I was boy, am I glad I'm not there, because I've spent so many hours in the Senate press gallery waiting for the Senate to do something and in a state of total confusion. So I sympathize. But really what that was all about is, you know, we've talked a lot about the schism in the Republican Party, obviously, between the Trumpers and the never Trumpers. And the sometimes Trumpers, which Mitch McConnell seems to be. But the but there is a schism, too, in the Democratic Party. And that is, and I think that's what you were seeing played out on Saturday morning, that there is a faction of the Democratic Party that really wants to go all to the wall on just unearthing what happened and trying to make, in their view, make the rest of the country understand just what a bad guy Donald Trump is. And then there is a faction, and that would be the faction that was pushing for witnesses. The other faction, which I think Joe Biden is a part of, it just says, let's move on. We have other things to do. We need to prove to the American people that we can actually accomplish something that matters to them. And so I think that's what you were seeing, the tension between those two factions of the party. And in the end, Biden won.
Ernest, it almost sounds like we need to send you to D.C. to have a conversation and tell some people it's not about them.
Maybe so.
It's not about you moment. For our next topic, I started thinking about when it was we talked about this, and I went into our archives to check some dates. It was October 28th when we were talking about the future of the Lincoln Project, how the Center of Right Political Action Committee was changing the hearts and minds of Republicans and reminding them about what the party stood for and that Donald Trump wasn't it. After the election, it turned its focus to Georgia and getting Ossoff and Warnock elected. And after January 6th, it had its eyes on Texas and here in Missouri, going after Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley. Now, the Lincoln Project is pretty much no more. And that's because it started with accusations of dozens of sexual harassment claims against co-founder John Weaver from Young Men and Boys. Then there was reporting from the Associated Press that $90 million that the group raised, only about a third of it actually went to pay for all of that advertising, leaving a lot of people to ask where the other $63 million went. And then there's a scathing piece on the 19th. You can read that on our links blog. It describes a toxic culture ripe with infighting, sexist language, and disparate treatment. Kathy, there is a lot there, isn't there?
Well, you know, looking back, it's probably not too surprising. You're dealing with some really titanic egos. I mean, the Lincoln Project attracted some top Republican consultants, all of whom are very powerful egos, very interesting, bright people. But it sounds to me like in the end, they were all kind of taking aim at each other. I think the other thing, just to bring this back to the topic we talked about at mm-hmm. the beginning of the show, this is really kind of the shock jockization of our political culture. And I think the kind of ambiance that was described in the 19th is all too typical in a lot of workplaces. And it's a lot because this kind of talk has been greenlighted by DJs, talk show hosts. You know, people love to kind of be the big macho guy and this very high testosterone culture. And I think, you know, in the end, clearly as things started to fray, and once this organization lost what brought it together, which is Donald Trump, things started to fray. But I think, and maybe it was inevitable that with all these egos, that was going to happen. But I think what the 19th story brought up is very much a part of the culture that we have been living in since the 1980s. And that is the culture that greenlights very negative, very funny sometimes, but very damaging rhetoric and ways of talking to each other and communicating.
There's another piece that's on our links blog, this one from the Jerusalem Post, that suggests that the lack of diversity within the core group is what ultimately led to this downfall, that had there been, even if the founders were to be the founders, even if there had been an environment within the organization that was more inclusive of race or of gender, it could have been the fact that it didn't was the sign that maybe this group didn't embody the values it claimed it did. Thoughts about that?
Well, Ernest, go ahead. Well, I mean, you know, I don't really understand where people thought that kind of environment was going to come from. I mean, this is an offshoot of the Republican Party that did not want to embrace Donald Trump. doesn't necessarily mean that they want to embrace all those things that you were talking about there. Kathy brought this point up. Once Donald Trump was out of the way, where were they going to go? Who was going to be what individual or what group was going to be the one that they go after next? They had no sort of unifying a figure or figures in which to go after. And I think that was a part of it. I think Kathy's also right, is that what you had is a bunch of egos of a bunch of, just be honest about it, a bunch of men of a certain age who had a bunch of egos, and they had been doing this pretty much for most of their career. And the one thing that got them was the fact that what's gotten everyone else in this Me Too movement is social media and individuals, many of them women, who have basically come out and said, we're not putting up with this anymore, and we're going to expose you for who you are and what you are. And the Lincoln Project got caught up in that, just as many other organizations on both sides have gotten caught up in that.
So while we talk about that, let's go to the other side. Not that we're involved in both sides-ism coverage, but let's go to the other side. The first scandal, if you will, to hit the Biden White House, the resignation of press aide T.J. Ducklow. It started with a question from Politico Playbook asking him about his romantic relationship with a reporter from Axios. Now stay with me for a second. While Playbook was waiting for his response to their questions, People magazine scooped Playbook and published a piece about the couple. We're going to talk about the relationships between journalists and political communications folks in a second, because that's not the primary problem here. That's just the secondary one. The primary one is what ended up getting him into trouble, telling the Playbook reporter that if she went ahead with her reporting, he would, in his words, destroy her. Kathy, he attempted to intimidate her, outright threatened her to squash the story, which is something that President Biden said on day one of the administration would not be tolerated, that disrespect for anyone would be, it would be a grounds for seeing the door. Now, he was originally suspended. He then gave his resignation. Thoughts about it?
Well, I mean, the Biden administration did the right thing. They walked the walk. And I think anybody who's covered the White House has been on the receiving end of a call like that, where, and particularly younger female reporters, where a press secretary or someone in the press office tries to intimidate a reporter out of doing something. That is, I think our strategic communication folks would say that is exactly the wrong tactic. When I hear from a reporter who's gotten a call like that, I double down. So it's a dumb thing to do. And in the current environment, it's a firing offense, and it should be.
So these relationships happen all the time. Maybe one of the biggest names that our people in our audience may recognize is Andrea Mitchell at NBC News. She's married to Alan Greenspan, the former Fed chair. The key to having a relationship like this, Ernest, is transparency and boundaries. And there's some reporting you can find on our Links blog about this and some other people who've been in this situation. Where and how do these problems fit in there? Could it have been that those boundaries maybe weren't as clear in this relationship as they should have been?
Well, I think, you know, we talk about boundaries. I think the boundaries has shifted. I mean, when you talk about, you know, the situation with Alan Greenspan and Andrea Mitchell, that was in a different era. And that boundary was set in a different place than where it's set right now. And I think what's where we are right now, and this sort of goes to what Kathy was talking about, is after 4 years of the culture of Donald Trump, Joe Biden and those around him have set that bar pretty high. And there are certain things that they're just not going to tolerate. And in turn, that boundary also shifts what the media expectations are and how they are supposed to conduct themselves and hold themselves accountable. And I think that's where we are now. So you had different boundaries sort of colliding here, where you can't threaten a reporter like that and get away with it. You could do it under Trump, but you're not going to be able to do it under Biden. But also, you can't have those kinds of relationships because that threatens the overall mission of what Biden is trying to do. And he wants to keep everyone on mission. That was one of the things that made a lot of the success that President Obama had under fierce criticism. And Biden is taking that same boat, is that nothing is going to stand in the way of the mission. And if you're an impediment to it, you're gone.
Okay, so before we go today, Britney Spears is back in the news following the release of a New York Times FX documentary framing Britney Spears.
When I first started, I didn't know what I was doing. But every day you learn more and you gain more wisdom from that.
Why is she still in this? Why is her dad making all of her decisions?
I have always viewed the situation as something that I don't think would have ever happened to a man in America.
Trust me, there are days that I struggle with myself.
I trust the system. I believe the law is aimed at actually protecting the conservatee.
There were things out there that have been said about me that aren't completely true.
We stand up for you, Britney Spears, and we won't stop until you reach freedom.
So for so long, the really bad joke had been to tell a friend facing tough times that if Britney could make it through 2007, they could survive anything. But Ernest, this really went into detail about how her father, Jamie Spears, used the law to take advantage of her and how he still manages to have complete control over her to this very day.
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the things, and I haven't seen it, but I've read a lot of stories about it. And one thing that this documentary does is pretty much take all of the stories that have been out there about Britney Spears and bring it into focus, and people can see that. And now they're kind of questioning whether or not this even should have taken place to begin with, and they want to do something about it. And people really feel like something needs to be done about it.
Kathy, one of the things that was noticeably missing from this documentary was either hearing from Britney Spears herself or anybody who is on her team. And there's an interesting piece from Good Housekeeping. That's usually a source that doesn't make it onto our blog too often, but that indicated that it was unclear if the New York Times or if people from FX and Hulu were even able to make positive connections with Britney or her team to even have a voice in it, or if they had been intercepted by her father because he has that right to control it.
You know, I have some problems with this documentary. I think this is a really sad story of a young woman, you know, and kind of the way our society, we're almost like vampires with celebrities. We mm-hmm. just suck dry. And here's a young woman who is very pretty, very talented. And because of her celebrity and what we do to celebrities, her life went off the rails. I think it's really hard to know what's going on inside a family. And I think it's dangerous to jump to conclusions about somebody's mental health and whether or not they need conservatorship. You can hope that our court system, which runs conservatorships, is keeping the interest of anybody who is in that situation in mind. But I feel like this documentary was almost a further exploitation. Can't get to the person herself, and you can't, and not only, it's one thing to say she can't talk because dad said no, but nobody else on the team. It doesn't feel like journalism to me.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate hearing that perspective on this too. That music means we're out of time today. There was one story I was hoping we'd get a chance to talk about. You can read about it on our links blog. It's about what happens when an 8-year-old asks NPR why they don't have more stories on All Things Considered about dinosaurs. You can read more about that on our links blog. That's on our website at kbia.org. You can find that under both the podcasts and programs tab. You can also download a recording of this program. You can get that there or on iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher. I'd like to thank you for being with us today. Also thanking Travis McMillan, Tim Pilcher, and Aaron Hay. See you next time.